You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about Earth Dinner, an effort to create a new Earth Day tradition.
First, federal health officials confirmed last week the Zika virus can cause serious birth defects like microcephaly and other serious brain anomalies. Microcephaly is an abnormal smallness of the head starting in infancy, which is associated with incomplete brain development. There has been an outbreak of Zika in South and Central America over the last several months, and the disease has spread through mosquitoes and unprotected sex.
While officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have warned that the Zika virus could spread further north than they previously thought, experts don't expect the virus to be transmitted here in Wisconsin. Dr. Nasia Suftar is with us now to talk about the threat of Zika nationwide and here in the state. She's the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the VA Hospital. Dr. Suftar, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, briefly remind us, what is Zika?
So Zika is a virus-borne illness caused by a flavivirus and transmitted by mosquitoes that has taken the world by storm since Brazil started reporting an unusually high number of cases and its association with congenital abnormalities in pregnant women.
Now, without pregnancy being involved, it seems like this virus doesn't have a strong impact on people, maybe not even noticeable symptoms. This could pass without people even knowing they have it in many cases. Is that right?
That's correct. So 80% of people will not have any symptoms, and 20% will have mild symptoms, you know, in the form of fever, a rash, joint pains, a headache, maybe red eyes for a few days. But generally, the symptoms are short-lived. People recover completely, and hospitalizations and complications are very rare, except in the case of the pregnant woman.
And in these pregnancies, very, very recently, it had been thought that almost certainly Zika was associated with microcephaly, with other development problems. Now it seems like we can take that word almost out. It's near certain at this point.
That is correct.
So let's talk about now the range of this disease, of Zika. The CDC announcing that the Zika virus could spread further north in the U.S. than previously thought. So how far is it expected to be spread and transmissible in the United States?
Well, so at least I think over 35 states have the capability of seeing local transmission of Zika virus. I think it all depends upon whether the vector, the particular mosquito that transmits Zika, is present in that in a particular state or not. And currently, at least, Wisconsin does not have the major vectors. At least most of Wisconsin doesn't have the major vectors that would transmit Zika. So I think it is unlikely that we would have a major issue with Zika.
But we haven't had any detected cases of Zika in the state. It sounds like it'll probably happen. We'll have Zika here one way or the other brought by travel. Somebody picks it up while traveling in the southern United States or beyond.
Yes, I think travel is going to be a very common thing, especially since most people are asymptomatic. They may come and not have symptoms when they arrive but develop symptoms here, or they may, you know, not have symptoms but be found to be positive by blood tests. So I think that's very likely that we'll see travel-associated Zika.
Talking to Dr. Nasia Suftar from UW-Madison. She's with UW Hospital and Clinics. Talking about Zika and its prospects for spread in the United States and Wisconsin, at present it looks like because of the mosquitoes we have, it's not likely to be heavily transmitted here in the state. Dr. Suftar, let's talk about precautions now for people, especially let's talk pregnant women in particular, traveling to Central or South America or through the summer to parts of the United States that could have this virus spreading. What kind of things should these women do?
So I think the most important thing is to, as the CDC recommends, is to really defer travel to the extent that it is possible. Now, sometimes that may not be possible for everyone. So in the event that a pregnant woman has to go to those areas where Zika is present and transmission is happening, I think the most important thing is going to try and prevent mosquito bites. So mosquito repellents are completely safe for pregnant women and should be used liberally. The other thing to remember is that unlike most other mosquitoes that are dusk biting, the virus that transmits Zika is day and night biting. So during the daytime, you're just as vulnerable as you might be at dusk. So again, you know, long sleeves, clothing, anything to deter the mosquito from getting to you and biting you is the idea.
And if someone gets the Zika virus and they're not pregnant, should they be worried at all?
You know, there's rare instances of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a disease that causes paralysis of the motor nerves. So those are very rare complications, and it's not unique to Zika. They can happen with other viruses as well. But as a general rule, I would say not to be worried unless you're a man, in which case you can transmit it to your partner, who, if they are pregnant, can then get Zika.
And that's the other mode of transmission. Is this something that pregnant women are being warned about, also avoiding unprotected sex while pregnant?
I think that's extremely important.
So vaccines are something that people are wondering about at this point. If there's a possibility, and if so, how quickly that could be an effective vaccine and safe vaccine could be developed. What kind of things are you watching for?
Well, so, I mean, as you know, currently there is no vaccine. There's a number of research groups, some at UW and certainly around the world, that are furiously working on solutions, whether it's therapeutics or whether it's vaccines specific to Zika. But most of these things, you know, take several months, if not years, to come to fruition to the point where they could be considered safe for human use. So I think at least for the current and possibly the next few seasons coming around, I don't think that vaccine will be a readily available option.
Zika is one of many mosquito-borne illnesses, not certainly the most lethal worldwide. We've got a lot, malaria and many others. Is Zika, do you think, going to help focus public effort, public health efforts on not just Zika, but other mosquito-borne illnesses as well?
Oh, I think so, because the same mosquito that transmits Zika also transmits dengue and chikungunya. So I think that it will help a number of other mosquito-borne conditions if we focus our efforts on preventing Zika.
As I look at care requirements or as suggestions, especially for pregnant women, I keep seeing the phrase avoid mosquito bites. And I think even just living here in Wisconsin, much less the tropics, yeah, right, this sounds like something that's really not that easy to do. But we can actually make a significant difference through more judicious use of mosquito repellent, long sleeve clothing, things like that.
I think so. I mean, I think we as a society, you know, mosquito repellents is not something that we use a lot of. People are already having to wear sunscreen and so on. But I think especially for the pregnant woman, if you are wearing sunscreen, then apply that first and then apply the mosquito repellent on top of it. It's completely safe, and so I see no good reason why we shouldn't do it if you know yourself to be at high risk. So there is some gains to be made there, I think, if you take those common sense measures, you know, not having standing water in your backyard, for example, in states that have the mosquito that is capable of transmitting Zika.
I wanted to ask you, as somebody who tracks infectious diseases, what do you make of this sudden spread of this disease? It's something that had been around in Africa for quite a few years and really just exploded, it seemed like, very suddenly in Brazil and then beyond.
You know, that's a really good question, to which I think the answer is not known. You know, why now and why so suddenly and why this explosion of Zika? I think are all unanswered questions. But I think we've learned from other viral conditions, you know, something even as relatively well-known as influenza, is that viral behavior, particularly those that are vector-borne, is dependent on a number of conditions and really fairly unpredictable, I think, despite our best efforts.
And then I want to ask about the public health monitoring system in Wisconsin. Whether we're talking about Zika or a new type of influenza or you name it, what kind of efforts do we have in place to see when these diseases arise and help coordinate an effort to prevent their transmission?
Well, so we have a really robust division of public health that is coordinating the Zika response. And I think one thing that from the diagnostic testing standpoint, all the specimens are being sent to the state lab. So they have a really good handle on who's being tested for Zika, and they would know of all positives. It is a nationally notifiable condition, both the viral infection itself and any complications that arise from it, such as the congenital anomalies we mentioned. So I think even though we think the risk of Zika in Wisconsin is low, one can never be too prepared, and so they've really got a good infrastructure in place for doing that.
So as Zika is in the news, as the weather's warming up, are you at your unit there getting a lot of calls about Zika?
We get calls from, women who, you know, anticipate getting pregnant or who are pregnant, wondering about travel and the risks of travel. And, you know, it's rare that our advice is, you know, don't travel. But in the case of Zika, that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, there's too many unknowns, the risk is too high, and if it's travel that can be deferred, then defer it.
Dr. Softar, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Dr. Nasia Softar. She's Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's faculty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and at the VA Hospital. She joined us to talk about the threat of the Zika virus nationwide and prospects for it here in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about an effort to mark Earth Day with a special holiday dinner.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Nature writer Jill Sisson Quinn tracked a muskrat around her yard for several months. In the process, she discovered a whole ecosystem both around her and within herself.
Lately, I've been on the trail of a muskrat. Before winter, his muddy mound of a home appeared through the leafless trees in a pond I have largely ignored. In spring, I encountered his tail-dragging tracks near a low bridge, and now, in summer, he seems to have vanished. Morning, evening, and afternoon stakeouts by what seems to be a feeding platform, a mat of mud and reeds and a cluster of cattails, have not revealed him. But since I have begun looking for one thing, I begin to see everything else. While I wait for the muskrat, wood ducklings paddle through the algaed pond as they once did their own yolks. Irregular rows of scented pond lily pads flap like the ruffles of a summer dress in unseasonable winds, showing their red undersides. Blue flag buds, not yet open, purse their petaled lips at my long intrusion. High up in a smooth stag completely shorn of bark, a family of pileated woodpeckers ducks angular red heads in and out, square pegs in a dark round hole. Under three logs nestle clutches of tiny freshwater pearl-like eggs, either redback salamander or land snail, I can't tell. One night, I hopscotch to the pond through a pleasant plague of microtoads. In one spot, on successive evenings, I rouse a small owl, twin fawns, and a gray tree frog. Next to him, under a downed branch, hides a blue-spotted salamander. I was looking for a muskrat, but I found a whole ecosystem. Ecosystem. A term coined less than a century ago when the English botanist A.G. Tansley wrote, "We cannot separate organisms from their special environment, with which they form one physical system." A term illustrated further by our own Aldo Leopold. When I worked as a naturalist, I hiked the children deep into the woods for a scavenger hunt and asked them to find, in addition to plants and animals, the environment's abiotic factors, water, minerals, sunlight. We are in the sun, actually. The heliosphere, the sun's outermost layer, extends beyond the orbit of Pluto. Not hard to believe when you venture to the pond in the evening, working specifically around a muskrat's perceived schedule, and find you can see absolutely nothing due to the glare of the setting sun. After my long vigils on the weedy shore of the pond, I worry about the scavengers on me. Ask my husband to take my book light and examine the places I can't see. We once spent 3 days, procured a magnifying glass even, trying to assure ourselves that a tiny spot on my left shoulder was not an embedded deer tick, but a freckle. When I return from my bushwhacking walks, sometimes I shake tiny beetles from my hair, cute speckled ones that wouldn't make anybody scream. But this is the least of it, really. Like the forest, like the pond, I am an ecosystem, hosting all kinds of microscopic life, mostly beneficial, on and inside me, 10,000 species, according to the Human Microbiome Project. So when I seek out the muskrat, regardless of whether I spot his slick-furred foraging, if I see the pond he swims in, I see him. For what we consider to be ourselves may be a strange invention, a fragile construct between two truer things— the world we harbor, and the world we anchor in.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
With Earth Day coming up later this week, our next guest says this is a good time to think about the food we eat and where it comes from.
She came up with the idea to create a special thematic meal to celebrate Earth Day. Joining us now to talk about her concept of an Earth dinner is Teresa Marquez, Mission Executive for Organic Valley. Teresa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so delighted to talk about Earth Dinner.
Well, tell us, what is Earth Dinner?
Well, I think I'll back up and say that in 2001, I had this thought about why wasn't Earth Day a national holiday? It's just so important to have one day a year that we acknowledge our faithful Earth. It just seemed like it made sense to me. And so I kept thinking, gee, I can't believe that we didn't. And, of course, in Wisconsin, Gaylord, Nelson started Earth Day. So, you know, why haven't we, you know, made this a national holiday or a big holiday that we all are going to celebrate? And the thing that really occurred to me is, well, there's no dinner. And when I think about all of the great holidays that we like to celebrate, there's some food that goes with it. And so I started thinking about how we needed a dinner to help celebrate Earth Day with, and that if we had this dinner, it would have to be very special and would have to be with the Earth in mind. And so that's kind of the way it came about. And really, the other reasons that I'm in marketing, even though my title is mission executive, I was chief marketing executive for Organic Valley for almost 18 years. So a lot of things crossed my desk, and a few things really brought that idea of having a dinner to celebrate Earth Day home for me. One was I read that 25% of our meals are eaten in a car. And then the second thing that struck me to go along with that was that we stopped having dinner with the family dinner tradition. Many stopped having that. And instead, there's TV dinners in front of the TV. And in fact, a terrible statistic that children actually and their parents only have something like 5 to 10 minutes of really meaningful time during the day, for each day. And it made me realize that I was brought up in a very strict house, and oh, you were at the table at dinner. And there's a lot more that happens at a dinner table than just, you know, scarfing down food.
Well, let's get into what this Earth dinner looks like, Teresa. What are the ingredients? What are the components that make an appropriate Earth dinner?
Well, I'll just tell you a few of them, but I also always encourage people to use their own imagination and really get creative, because it's a great time to get creative. But of course, you want to know where your food comes from. And it's not like we're going to say, and only eat organic and only eat local. But, you know, once a year, wouldn't it be great to say, you know, I know where this food comes from. And the other thing that I love to advise is to have food with a story. Like, I like to think about, what did my grandmother eat? What did my family eat? Should I resurrect something or make something that my mother used to make, but maybe make it in a new way and be also honoring her? And while I'm also honoring where that food came from, what's its story, and, you know, why should we even care about where our food comes from? Since 2001, so many things have happened with regards to different organizations wanting to know your farmer, know your food. You just see these all over the place. So I think I was onto something when I thought, shouldn't we know where our food comes from? And, of course, the really, really important thing is to have your friends and family around and to share stories and talk about the food and where it came from and our connection to the earth. We're all connected. And so I think the Earth Dinner is an opportunity to really think about all the connections that we have with each other around food and how it comes from the earth. And one piece of information that I always find quite fascinating is that, you know, that one teaspoon of soil has more living things in it than there are people on earth. And it kind of gives you pause for a thought that this wonderful food that we forget to think about, we just are scarfing down a lot of times, really comes from the soil, a lot of it. And it's a kind of a magical thing.
And Teresa, I want to get a taste. What's been maybe the biggest hit that you've put on the table on one of these Earth dinners?
I think that right here in the Midwest in April, April 22nd, who came up with that time for Earth Day? But it should have been like in the fall when we're harvesting things. So when we start looking around here, we love to do things with morels and rants that you can find wild right outside right now, and so that's always a fun thing. The important thing, of course, is to know where your food comes from if you possibly can, and anything that you came from your family is always a fun story to talk about. One of the things that we did do to sort of stimulate these creative ideas of, gee, what should we have for dinner, or what's some of the great things is we actually came up with a deck of cards to stimulate conversations, and you could pick one. And I'll just tell you what one of the favorite cards were, and it actually resulted in so many funny stories. But it's like, do you have a first memory of food? And if so, please share it with us. And so from there, we learned a lot about different food that people were both their favorites and their worst. And we found some of the memories of food where people, when they were little, remembering how much they disliked cauliflower, and when their mother wasn't looking, they would put it behind the radiator.
Sounds like a great conversation starter, Teresa. Thank you so much for sharing this idea of Earth Dinner with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Teresa Marquez, Mission Executive for Organic Valley, talking about an Earth Dinner, a special meal to celebrate Earth Day. And now, nowadays, I would never hide that cauliflower behind the radiator. Love this stuff, especially baked in the oven.
Cauliflower is very in style right now, too. It's been overlooked for too long.
Well, coming up, we look at how Americans feel about their local libraries and explore how libraries are setting themselves up for a technology-driven future. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7 on Reveal, a look at allegations of discrimination in the temp worker industry.
First, new research, shows Americans generally think their community libraries do a good job providing educational services, even if they aren't always aware of everything those libraries have to offer.
A report from the Pew Research Center looked at how people use libraries for learning, and a study from last year looked at library use among different segments of the population.
All told, people generally like their libraries, but use is dropping off.
Lee Rainey joins us now. He's the Director of Internet Science and Technology Research at Pew Research Center. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, just in broad strokes, how do people feel about libraries these days?
One of the most interesting things that's happening in many communities is that libraries are trying to adjust to the digital age. They're adding services and programs, and they're particularly focused these days in many communities on educational opportunities. So we were very focused in this survey of adults in America about how do they feel their library is doing in terms of serving the educational needs of their community and of their own families. And the numbers are pretty good. 76% of adults said the local library served the community needs well when it comes to education, and 70% said it serves the needs of them and their families well.
So those are high marks, and in terms of how often people are going to the library, what do we see?
Library use is in flux. There are now, in addition to going to the buildings and the bookmobiles themselves, people can access library websites, or they can even use apps on their phones. And there's been a little bit of a dip in the past few years as we've been measuring this of patronage of libraries over the course of a 12-month period. So in 2012, the first time we asked this question, about 53% of adults said they'd been to a library or bookmobile in the past 12 months. That's now fallen a bit to 44%. But at the same time, the number of people using library websites has gone up a little bit. It's gone from 25% in 2012 to 31% now. And so there's a shift in the way people are using libraries. And, of course, now on your smartphones, about 9% of Americans use a library app on their phone to get books or to get resources that are available through their libraries. So it's an institution that's in flux, like a lot of other places that are built around media and knowledge.
If we look at the number of people who are actually visiting the libraries and how that may be down a bit, is there enough data to say, hey, we've got a trend here, or do we need more data points?
I think we need a little bit more data points. These are the first times that we at the Pew Research Center have asked about the share of adults going to libraries, and we only have a 3-year trend on it. But it's clear that people are thinking differently about libraries now, and there are lots of ways in which they are sort of clamoring for new kinds of services, even as many communities don't want their libraries to do too much messing around with the books. They love the books, they love the printed books, but they're also thinking about borrowing e-books as well now and having other kinds of services offered by this very central community institution.
What kinds of other things do people want?
Well, they would love libraries to get very connected to educational services. So 85% of adults say they'd love libraries to provide special classes for children and coordinate with schools so that there is a sort of a less of a mismatch between what's being assigned in classrooms and what's available at libraries. There's also a lot of support in the nation for libraries offering pre-K education programs. There's a very distinct feeling in the culture that there are new literacies required in the digital age. Not only do you have to read and write well, but you also need to know how to use technology in order to be sort of a good, high-functioning citizen. And they think libraries could do a good job before schools even begin to teach kids, helping with educational efforts, and especially aimed around technology.
It's interesting that people are so interested in bringing these educational aspects more into focus, because there are educational services that libraries provide already, and it sounds as though from your survey people don't always know about them. What did you find there?
Yeah, it's interesting that libraries are very aggressively scrambling to provide new services, starting with e-books and for borrowing for free. And about 62% of American adults say that free e-book borrowing is available in their community. The problem is 90% of community libraries offer ebook reading. So a lot of people don't know that ebook borrowing is possible there, and the numbers get even worse for other kinds of educational programs. A lot of people don't know that their local library probably offers online career and job-related resources, or offers GED or high school equivalency programs, or even sort of tips and resources for entrepreneurs and small business people to start up their businesses, and even offering certification programs that people have learned new skills. So there are lots of ways that libraries are trying to adjust to the new educational needs of their communities, and people are kind of tuned into that, but it's still, they've got a long way to go now to teach people all of the resources that are available at their local library.
We're talking with Lee Rainey right now from the Pew Research Center, looking at some new research on how people feel about libraries and what groups of people are more likely to use libraries. Do we know?
Yeah. Women are more likely than men to use libraries. Perhaps the single most dramatic group using libraries is families with young children. Those are among the most happy and most aggressive users of libraries. People who have relatively high levels of household income and relatively high levels of education are also particularly likely to use libraries and to also use library websites.
And in terms of where libraries can go from here, what are some of the areas that you're going to probe more deeply next time you'll be watching?
Well, there are lots of conversations all over the country, and I'm sure in Madison, as much as any place else, about how to fit into educational ecosystems. Where can they plug in and serve people's needs? There's also really strong interest in libraries adding to the suite of technologies that they provide. So lots of libraries are creating maker spaces. They have 3D printers, or they have other technologies that allow people to essentially be creative with tools that they borrow from the library. There's also tremendous interest in libraries serving the needs of veterans or active duty military personnel, so maybe creating special programs for those groups, and also for serving immigrants. Even though it's a challenging political environment in some respects for serving immigrants, there is lots of support throughout the nation in libraries offering services to help immigrants integrate into their communities.
Is this growth in people being interested in digital libraries and maybe people visiting the actual, you know, brick and mortar libraries less? Is there any sense of what people want to happen to the actual buildings themselves and the books?
Well, they're very enthusiastic about programs that essentially enhance the role of libraries as community centers. So it's not just a place where you go in and you borrow resources, but it's a place where people can meet, or where there are programs, or whether there are special learning activities taking place. A lot of libraries, maybe it's true in Madison, have gaming special nights and gaming centers that that are very popular with teenagers. And so Americans kind of want their libraries to do what they've always done, which is to be everything to everyone. It's an enormous challenge in an era of tight budgets for libraries, for librarians to figure out how do we best serve all of these competing demands of our patrons.
It sounds as though you use the phrase transition, libraries are transition. Are there troubling signs here for libraries, or is it a story that hasn't been finished yet?
Oh, and it's definitely a story that hasn't been finished yet, but it's as challenging, for instance, as the news business. Libraries have been as disrupted as certainly the newspaper business has, and I would argue even the radio and television businesses have, to adjust to the realities of the digital age where people on their devices that they carry around can get all the information, all the media, all the news that they would care to get. So librarians have been trying to figure out where they fit into a very new media and information ecosystem. And it's a conversation that's just going to keep continuing because there are so many new demands and new constituencies and new gadgetry that give people opportunities to take advantage of all this stuff.
Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Lee Rainey from Pew Research Center talking about Americans' attitudes toward libraries.
Coming up, we'll hear from Madison Public Library about how libraries are setting themselves up to be a resource in the future, and we'd like to hear from you.
How do you use your local library? What programs have you used at your local library? And what are some of the programs and resources that you wish they had? How can libraries remain a valuable resource in a technology-driven world? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about libraries now and talking about what directors are doing to make sure they're a valuable resource in an ever-changing future.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you use your library? Do you check out books? Do you check out audiobooks on your smartphone like I do? Do you go to your library for 3D printing? Do you check out cake pans? I know there's at least one library that you can go to their cake pan collection. What do you go to your library for? What do you wish you could go to your library for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Tana Elias joins us now. She's the Digital Services and Marketing Manager for Madison Public Library. And Tana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just talked about what people think about libraries' attitudes. And one area that came up in this recent Pew survey was that people want a lot of educational aspects to their library, a lot of programs, but they don't always know about them when they're there. Is that something you've seen with your work with Madison Public Library?
It is. The Pew findings are very similar to what we see at Madison Public Library, where there are many different things available at the public library, and people generally tend to think of books and other materials to check out. Maybe they think of story times, but they don't necessarily think that libraries have businesses on how to use social media or classes for how to use social media for your business, for example. They don't always know that we have ebooks, even though that's a largely growing collection. They don't know that we have after-hours programs. They don't know that our Meadow Ridge Library has a community kitchen. So many different things are happening in a learning-wise and a event-wise that many people don't know about.
Well, how would people find information like that?
We do have information on our website. We do market within the library, but more and more we find we are working with community partners who are reaching a targeted audience to let them know about things the library offers for them. One example is that we work with WIBIC, the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corp, to co-teach classes on how to start a business, how to write a business plan, using library resources, but working with them to hit their target market.
And in terms of how people are looking, what they want from libraries in the future as we go forward, what sorts of things are you hearing from people who use Madison Public Library?
Well, we are hearing over and over again that people want community spaces. So they may have internet at home, but they really want to connect with others. They want to learn in a more hands-on manner. They want to connect and engage with people in the library spaces. They want to connect with collections outside of the library. So we're definitely hearing more mobile, more online, and then more participatory as well.
Let's take a caller now at 800-642-1234 as we look at the future of libraries. And Austin is with us in Madison. Austin, hi.
Hi. When university students go to libraries, they usually bring books, laptops, all the materials they need with them. but they use a library as a comfortable, productive space to be in. And I think that other libraries could offer that to a wider population.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Austin. And what about those comfortable spaces? People want to bring their materials there and work, and that's something that has shown up in some of these Pew survey centers. What do you think?
That's definitely what we're hearing. In the professional literature, we call it the third space. So not home, not school or work, but the third space where you want to go, you want to use the internet, you want to connect with other people through a program, or maybe you just want to use a study room and work on your own. So we're definitely hearing that people are really looking for that experience from public libraries.
Public libraries as a community space is a concept that is evolving. What do you see as the cutting edge of that? What are people doing in Wisconsin and beyond?
Well, I know of some libraries not in Wisconsin that are doing co-working spaces actually in the library. So we have similar projects in Madison, not in public libraries, but there are libraries on the East and West Coasts that are offering co-working. Our Meadow Ridge Library has a community kitchen, and that came out of a community demand from that neighborhood, that southwest side of Madison, where food was a connector. There were many programs in the area around food, and we are located adjacent to the Meadow Ridge Neighborhood Center and library are together. And then in between those two spaces is a kitchen and a community space where people can meet and have events, community suppers. We offer free meals at that site for seniors and for children during the summer. So lots of different ways to use public libraries.
When you mentioned something like a kitchen, that would never be the first place that my mind went when I thought about what a library was. So are you having to sort of re-answer the question, what is a library?
We do. We answer that question on an ongoing basis. And what we feel a public library is what our community wants. And that need differs from place to place depending on resources that are in the community.
I mean, is there such a thing as a working definition?
Of a public library?
Yeah.
You know, I think... Yes, I think there are some basics that you can take for granted. We'll always have books. We'll always have reference librarians available to answer questions. We'll always have programs around literacy, whether it's early literacy or digital literacy. But I think the room for expansion is immense. There are many different things that we can do.
And we just heard from the Pew Center about people looking for some hands-on learning and other educational aspects for pre-K learners. Is that something that you see as being a growing field in Madison and Wisconsin?
Definitely. We know that there are significant gaps in the Madison community, so we are really working with community partners in the Madison area to reach out to children who especially need those early literacy experiences and who can benefit most from them.
We're talking right now with Tana Elias from Madison Public Library. She's telling us how libraries are emerging and changing to respond to their community. And another thing picked up by the Pew Center is that people seem to be going to libraries less. So a little bit, that's a trend at least from 2012. Is that something that's concerning or something that you're seeing?
We are seeing people use libraries in different ways. Our statistics follow the national statistics that Pew have mentioned. We saw a peak of both checkouts and visits around 2009, and we're seeing a very slow, gradual decline. But with that in mind, we're also seeing big increases in internet use, in program attendance, in ebook checkout. So while we're seeing overall numbers decline, we're seeing increases in certain areas.
And it would be great to hear from our listeners on this at 800-642-1234. Are you still going to the library as often as you used to go? At about since 2009, if you have small children, is this still a hub of your life, or is it something that maybe you're turning to different resources now? And what would you like to see from your library? You can call us at 800-642-1234. And as time and technology change, how do you see libraries and librarians starting to adapt as you look at that future?
We're trying to find out what people need most in dealing with those changes. One big area that we see are digital literacy skills for the workforce. We see many people coming to us every few years or so wanting to learn new skills for their job, wanting to get a new job maybe, or increase their potential, their earning potential. So they come to libraries looking for those resources to help them learn those skills.
And how can a library help with that job search?
We have a lot of different resources, and we have experts that are trained to help you navigate the system. So anything from an online application form for somebody who's maybe not very versed in computer skills, navigating that, or finding ways to start your own business plans, and other resources. And then also, people are using public libraries to connect with others. So they're using public library events as networking resources.
Let's go to a caller now. We have Rhonda on the line in Menominee. Rhonda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you about the Menominee Public Library. We're doing so many of the things there. We have something really nice, led by a woman, Jean Crusoe Larson from Knapp, Wisconsin, that wrote a book about knitting, and she leads a knitting club at our library, and it's come to be knitting and crocheting, and people of different ages coming together and doing that. We also have a community reads program where every year our library sponsors a book for the community, and we have discussions around that. And for our young children, we just had a really great musician, Jim Nelson, come and do some in-service with preschoolers. And he's a local musician from the Cutaways, and he came to our library and led a really nice thing. So we have constant interaction with our community at our local library.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on there, Rhonda. Thank you so much for calling us and telling us about that. And hearing some of those things there, a knitting club, for instance, is this sort of the sort of thing that the communities are asking for and is being provided?
Definitely. We have knitting clubs in many of our libraries. We have book-to-art programs where we read a book and do a related art project. So we're definitely seeing people interested in doing things at the library in groups, connecting with each other, and the library is kind of the platform or the backdrop.
And do you think that so far libraries are responding fast enough to meet needs?
Yeah, I think we are. I think most libraries are being proactive and trying to get out there and find what their community needs are and looking at national trends as well.
Tana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tana Elias from Madison Public Library telling us how libraries are remaining important to the community in a rapidly changing world.